there, friends. Thank you so much for joining us for yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
We are so hyped today. Like, I know we've been getting such good guests recently, but I feel like today's, I am just beside myself with glee. Today we are joined by none other than Tori Peters.
Hi, I'm so thrilled to be here.
We are Hi, thank you so much.
Thank you. I feel like we have royalty in our midst. It's so exciting.
Yeah, because we've been on the hype train for a while. Like, even like we did like an episode when Detransition Baby came out. Like, we have firmly nailed our flag to, I don't know what the expression is, but we have been very open about our levels of hype for Detransition Baby. So we feel so hashtag blessed to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And also,
I'm also
this
happy with the flag you've nailed. I don't know exactly what the metaphor is, but any flags,
you know what I mean.
I'm into. Yeah, no, I'm very into it. Thank you for
planted a hype flag in the tundra.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, this is an exciting time because we get to say congratulations to you because you've been shortlisted for the British Book Awards Discover Book of the Year, which is so hype.
Yeah, I'm pretty thrilled about it. I'm going to be in the UK, so I get to go to the ceremony, which is the first time, you know, because of COVID, that I've actually gotten, there's been like a few other kind of nominations, and it's like, you know, it's great to be nominated, but it is also very funny to sort of like be like, I got this award, and now I'll close the laptop. And so this is one where I actually get to like go and, you know, dress up and have like a ceremony.
And celebrate in person, which is so nice.
Yeah.
Experience a bit of the glamour.
Exactly. Just a little bit. Just, you know, I've been missing it these last 2 years.
Yeah, I think if you are someone who likes to go out and chat to people, get the goss in person, see what's going on, it's been tough to be starved of these little, you know, events and awards and places that you get like the level of chat that you wouldn't like DM someone on Twitter about it, but you just like casually chat about it in person.
Yeah, I mean, it's more just like it's not like I like want everyone to like, you know, have an opportunity to like praise in person at an awards ceremony or something, but it's just sort of like I want this whole last 2 years to start feeling real, because I know it like exists in the world, but for me, it's funny for you to talk about like a hype train or something, because like that for me, my life before and after is the same, which is like I'm sitting in a computer in the apartment talking on a computer, and I just like, I feel like going to the UK, like getting on a plane, crossing an ocean, dressing up, like, you know, like caring kind of about that whole thing is like, it's going to finally be like, this is real, you know?
Yeah, because I guess that didn't even occur to me going into this interview, that when exactly did Detransition Baby come out in the UK? It was 2020, wasn't it?
It was January, I think in the UK it was January 5th of 2021. So it was like
21 rather, yeah.
Yeah, that was like the first kind of like really like dark winter, you know?
Like, that was a very dark winter because we had like come out of lockdown and then had gone back in a much more like austere way, paired with like bad dark weather, whereas like our first lockdown it was weird and scary but the sun was shining, so the vibe felt slightly different. What a time to have a book out.
This might seem like almost a silly question, but releasing your debut novel, because I know you had released novellas beforehand and we'll get to those later, but releasing your debut novel in that specific period of time, did its success take you by surprise?
I mean, it did, absolutely, because the funny thing is that it's kind of slow. Like, I mean, it's funny looking back on it like a year, you know, almost 2 years later now, and that, like, I think actually one of the reasons it was successful is that it happened very slowly. Like, it was like it found the right readers initially, and there wasn't a huge amount of like, you know, kind of response to it. And then like a month later, it started getting reviews, and then there was like the Women's Award, and then it was like chosen for all this like Pride stuff, and it was like the way that it moved is like it moved slowly to the right readers. And like one of the interesting things now that's happening is it just came out in Germany in translation like a week or two ago. And I think one of the things that I've noticed in what's happening once released in Germany is that they already expected it to sort of be, I don't know, like a big hit or like a big commercial novel. And so it's like, and I think that one of the reasons it's sort of like, you know, do you want to be on like morning shows or do you want to like have big splashy things? And I think a lot of people don't know necessarily what to do with this novel when it's like released as like, this is the novel for everybody. Whereas the way that I think it happened for me is like, it just, because it was so slow, it got to the right people and then eventually got big rather than like starting out in the big places. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's like funny to like, you people in Sweden are like, you should come on the morning shows when I go to Sweden. And I'm like, I don't think this is like a morning shows novel, you know?
But they do.
Right. Because I I'm almost like, let it go slow. Like, let it like trickle out to the right people. And like, eventually then you'll want me on the morning show. But like, I'm not sure. I mean, whatever. Publicists probably know this stuff better than me. But this has been my feeling about it. Much as I'm loath to be like, I don't want to go on the morning. Of course, I would love to go on the morning shows, you know.
Yeah, no, I get your position. So did you not really have any sense that it was going to pop off? Like, has it sort of outperformed your expectations?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I wrote the, you know, I self-published. Like you said, we talked about it. Like, my previous two novels were, you know, they were Create Space on Amazon. I gave them away for free on the internet. You know, when I sold them for like $8. And I would ship them myself. So it was like, I had an audience, even I had like a little bit of like a fan audience that was willing to do this, but it was maybe 800 people, you know? And I didn't know if it was going to be on a big press. I didn't know. I was writing it like nobody was listening when I was writing it. And that gave me like a lot of freedom to say whatever I wanted. And then it was like there were these small hurdles each time, and I was like, oh, it did get picked up by a press. Oh, they do seem to be like promoting
marketing it.
Oh,
yeah,
now it's a lead title. I wasn't expecting that. And then like, and so it was like each thing was like a slow kind of next level. Like if it had started out, if they had come to me and they'd been like, okay, we like your book and we think you should be on like a morning show like right out of the gate, I would have been like, whoa, I actually think you're misunderstanding this novel, you know? And now it's almost like what the novel has done has proven me wrong in what I think, but I definitely wasn't expecting it. And the whole thing had this like aura of unreality because I was only ever seeing it through a laptop. I wasn't going to an awards show. I wasn't going to studios. It was like a pretend thing that was happening online. Like I was like role playing being a successful author online or something.
And yet it was real.
Yeah. Well, here we are, we're talking. So it must have actually happened.
And would you say that the success of Detransition Baby affected how you write now?
I'm trying to make it not, you know, like that's the thing is that like, I think that feeling like there's a lot of people who are going to read it can have a real chilling effect on the kind of jokes I make. You know, I like to make jokes. I like to make sometimes like risque jokes. And if I'm thinking about like, oh, if I make this joke, here's like all the ways it's going to be misinterpreted by, you know, it's going to be misinterpreted by like bigots who are going to find transphobic things to say about it. But it's also going to be like misinterpreted maybe by people in my own community. I find it like that I was not sensitive enough in making this joke. And so I can just like think of like all the different people who will criticize me for something that's like, and then I'm like, I don't even really care about this joke, maybe I'll just cut it. And I think that's like the exact wrong instinct. It's like, if it's going to piss off everybody everywhere, then like, that's a good joke. Leave it in. You know, but it's hard. It's like before there was no hurdle to doing that. There was no barrier. Cause I was like, yeah, like, you know, 16 people are going to read this joke and they know me personally. And so I don't care. Whereas now I'm suddenly having to like imagine this, like, you know, coliseum of people who might boo me, and it can be really stifling. So I have to sort of pretend that none of this happened in order to keep writing.
Yeah, I guess it's harder to write like no one's reading if you know that thousands and thousands of people are actually reading.
Yeah, I actually do this exercise where I force different things. I sort of make a kind of like pantheon of readers. That is like 8 readers. And I just like, I'm self-consciously like choose like maybe 4 famous writers and like 4 friends. And I'm like, that's my audience. And if those 8 imagined people like this, it's good enough. But, you know, because I can't actually think about everybody else. So I've had to like consciously make these like writing exercises in order to like tell myself like who's, and I'll even like add some people who I know are like against me. Like I'll add like a, I don't know, like a transphobe or something to the imagined audience. I'm like, what's that person going to say when I do this? And just so I'm expecting it and know it's happening in order to like basically have the bravery to continue writing and not be like shut down by the idea of a huge audience.
Mm. Yeah, because I feel like one of the things that we loved so much about Detransition Baby was using, you know, quite like complex and sometimes quite spiky and difficult characters to explore like themes or plots that I have not read in like a mainstream, you know, in a book published by like a mainstream publisher. Like, do you feel that like kind of more or less free to go to those like more complicated or like taboo places now that you know that you have so many readers?
I feel less free. I feel like I would think that I'd be empowered, but in fact, like, one of the things that happens is I'm, you know, I had never really prior to this been read in bad faith. Like most people knew me, and so they, if they read me in bad faith, I'd be like, you know, Jessica, what are you doing? You know, I could like call that person up. And now it's like, oh, actually some people are going to read this in bad faith. They're going to, or they're going to, you know, bring, I don't know what everybody's like particular histories or traumas or whatever that they're bringing to a book. And suddenly I'm like, oh, maybe if I just discuss this in a cavalier way, people are going to be hurt by it. And suddenly this is this huge responsibility that I don't know what to do with as a writer. And so I mostly have been trying to like shove that away from me so that I can actually say the things that I care about. And usually the things that I care about are things that there's like tension in my life around things that it's that are hard to talk about. Like if something's easy to talk about, I can generally solve it in my own life. It's the stuff that's difficult to reconcile with, like, you know, reconcile between like my desires and my politics. Like sometimes I want things that like my politics say are bad, or, you know, and how do I reconcile those things? Writing is usually the place that previously I did reconcile that stuff. And it was largely for me. And suddenly it feels like, oh, in that process, I could, what used to be just for me now feels like it could hurt other people.
You know? Yeah. And the stakes are higher for you as one of the few kind of out visible trans authors than they are for like any random cis author, I guess. And that is, you know, I guess a big mental load to bear.
Yeah. I mean, it's partly why I want more trans writing, not because like for like this political reason of like, oh, there should be more trans writers, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, I just want other trans writers so that like I get to do whatever I want and whatever weird things I say. Like, I can just be like, it's not like, oh, that's a trans thing. It's just like, oh, that's like Tori's weird obsessions, you know, instead of, belong to me, you know? I envy that more than I envy some sort of like political righteousness about it.
So with that in mind, how do you feel about the release of your novellas? So we've got a quartet of novellas coming out in the UK next year in 23, two of which were previously self-pubbed. Am I right in saying this?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that older writing kind of coming out to a new audience in the UK?
I mean, that stuff is, some of that stuff is really edgy. Like, people.
Okay, I'm down. I'm excited.
Yeah. People who were, you know, transphobic bigots, I'll just say it, have actually gone through that past writing, like, excerpted pieces of it. And even though it's fiction, they've, like, again, in bad faith, like, attributed it to me. Like, this is Tori Peters saying this, rather than, like, confused and difficult characters saying problematic stuff in the way that, like, I think fiction is great at doing. You can have a character say stuff that's, like, a problem, or you can have characters make mistakes. And so there's a way in which I feel like these novellas open me up, because they can be wielded against me, and they have already been wielded against me in, like, a larger sort of, like, international political discourse around trans rights. Whereas, like, when I created them, they were for working through, like, as you say, spiky problems between trans women, like, working through shame, working through, like, what's the place of, like, you know, trans women who learn about their gender through, like, sexual fetishes, you know, things that are, like, not respectable or that are taboo, but that, like, still exists. Like, people learn about their gender through sex, and so, and not all sex is, like, happy, shiny, fun times. And so a lot, like, the novellas were even more than Detransition Baby, they were the places that I was, like, working out those themes. So I think that, like, I definitely feel like I'll be more vulnerable in putting this old stuff out there. But also, because it's older, I am also like, yeah, just put it out there. Like, I'm not actually the writer who wrote that stuff anymore. And it feels like, you know, even if people find it challenging and they have problems with what I'm saying in those novellas, or if it's just like this, you know, that's okay. And also, I feel like people are like, this is really not for me, because in some ways I think the novellas are mainstream and that they're, like, doing genre moves, but in some ways they're I think some people who are like, we really like this because it was like a soap opera, Detransition Baby, I mean, they might look at the novellas and be like, oh, this is, like, these are doing different things. Maybe we'll wait for the next Detransition Baby. And that's also okay with me. I'm just sort of, like, preparing myself for it beforehand.
But I guess because some of the, you know, two of them are out there already, hopefully that also alleviates some of that concern. Like, they're already out there. People know what the subject matter is, and they can be empowered to choose whether or not they want to engage with it. I, for one, am ready to engage. I'm excited.
Well, thank you. I mean, I love that. And I do, I love that, like, way of seeing it. And I do, I like to give readers credit for just basically being like, look, if you don't like this, you can close the book. You know, like, I love a reader who just, like, who, you know, gets to page 7 of Detransition Baby and it's like, I don't like this. This way of talking about pregnancy makes me feel uneasy. And you just shut the book. And I'm like, I want those readers. I want the readers who instead of being mad at a book, if they think it's bad for them, just shut it, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So you said you self-published, you said you self-published two of those novellas. Like, do you think that that is still a great place for, like, a kind of debut trans writer to begin, or like, in order to kind of tread a more traditional path to publication, like, how do you feel about self-publishing now?
I'm a big fan. I mean, part of it was that I'd had all this practice finding my audience and talking to the audience. You know, for me, I was part of a scene that was about trans women writing for other trans women, And the idea was, you know, taken from a lot of other minority literature, you know, especially Black American literature, where Black Americans were writing for other Black Americans, and the idea was that everybody else could keep up. You know, Toni Morrison being like sort of one of the most famous examples of this, and you know, she wrote explicitly for Black women, and everybody else got the benefit. And the idea was for trans writing was very similar, that it was like, we'll write for each other without ever slowing down, with the same high bar that you'd need to impress other trans women. And then the thing is, we will trust readers to be able to keep up. We'll trust readers who are cis to like use Google, you know, to like, if they need to read with the phone in their hand, looking up words, like we trust them to do that. But we're not going to like slow down the stories because of that. You get a high bar and you get like a full out sprint. And so it was with self-publishing that I learned how to talk to that audience, where the audience lives, like what was working, what wasn't working. And I felt really empowered also in terms of like the actual process of like, I had done it already myself. So I knew everything that went into writing a book, you know, even just page layout, cover design, where to try and release the books, where to find the audience. Like I had all these like little guerrilla campaigns that I did so that when it came time to work with, you know, Penguin Random House, the biggest publisher in the world, I wasn't just like wide-eyed, like you guys tell me what to do. I was like, I have a vision for how this book can get out there. I know where to find the trans audiences. I know where to talk to the trans audiences. Mm. Meanwhile, you guys are the best in the world in like, because I basically saw Detransition Baby as like a trans iteration in a long tradition of women's literature. And I was like,
yeah,
Penguin Random House, you guys are the best in the world at finding, you know, this market for women's literature. You don't have to reinvent the wheel here, because sometimes you get a trans, I would talk to publishers and they get a trans book and they'd like start fumbling it and they'd have no idea what to do because they thought it was something new. And I was like, this isn't new. This is just the trans version of something that you are the best at the world of doing. Just do what you already do with it. Don't try and overthink it. And it was because I had self-published that I had the confidence to tell them that. And then when they, once they heard it, they were like, oh, we can do what we're already the best at doing. They went and did it. And it worked exactly as I had thought it would work, you know, when I was just doing it on my own, you know, for a much smaller audience, you know, just tinkering around in InDesign, doing the layouts myself.
So I'd love to hear more about the trans writing scene that you were part of in Brooklyn. Like, how did that come about and how supportive was it for you?
I mean, it was, I like to say that it was like, you know, sort of like we wanted it to be like Paris in the 20s for trans writers, or like Harlem Renaissance for trans writers. And in a romantic way, that's true. But like what you don't really think about when you think about these like storied movements is actually that everybody's like a struggling artist and there's a lot of scarcity and a lot of like personalities. So it's actually like a lot, and everybody's like sleeping with each other and there's like all this drama and all that sort of stuff. And so there was this pressure of all these people trying to make art together and coming up with both like an artistic and political ethos around it. And there was like, we started a small, so basically what happened is all these trans women and trans writers in general had moved to Brooklyn in like the late aughts. They'd started writing, they were doing media, and they were basically like, so much of the writing about trans stuff is just explanation for cis audiences. And what if we started writing for each other? And so they started a small, my ex-boyfriend, Tom, started a small press called Topside Press, which he ran out of his living room, and he published first an anthology of short work, and it ended up winning like a Lambda Award. It was, and all these people were like, we want to be in it. And then he published this book called Nevada, which is being reissued by FSG.
Yes.
I forgot who's doing it in the UK.
Picador. Yeah, Picador.
And that was a book that was just like kind of blew everyone's mind because it was like, oh, this is what it sounds like when trans women talk to each other. And we'd never read that. We'd never heard like our own kind of voices. Like we'd read them on message boards and we'd seen it online and we knew how we talked to each other, you know, online, but I'd never read it in a literary format. And it was like this voice that I knew suddenly telling stories at such a bigger scale. The argument wasn't like, oh, I didn't have to think through the argument. I just felt it. I was like, this is what it feels like to be addressed by a book, which everybody else has, you know, have been experiencing in literature for so long. It was so exciting. I wanted to talk back. And there were two other books that ended up getting published by that press that got published, but two really made a mark, Sybil Lamb and Casey Platt published their books, Safe Girl Love and I've Got a Time Bomb. And they did like this sort of punk tour where they drove around and any trans woman who wanted to could read with them. Like they would go to these various cities and like go to bars or anarchist spaces and they would read, and if you were trans and you wanted to read, you could get up on stage with them. So it was like really a community thing rather than like two authors being lifted. So they came, I was in Seattle at the time, and they came to Seattle and they were like, do you want to read with us? And I read with them and I totally bombed because I hadn't taken up their insights. I wrote some stuff that was like, it just wasn't on the level. And it was so exciting to actually, I mean, it was hurt. You never want to bomb. It feels terrible to like,
yeah, God,
like, everybody hates this. But also it was so incredible to be like, everybody hates this. What am I doing wrong? How can I get better? Which is, you want that as a writer. You want the moments where you're like, oh my God, I can be so much better. And I think there's a path to being so much better. And I ended up moving to Brooklyn, being part of the scene. Again, for like reasons of drama and scarcity and all this stuff, that scene sort of collapsed. And in the sort of like ashes of that scene, I started self-publishing those books. And I was self-publishing largely because the way that that scene fell apart was about all the writers who were there, there just wasn't enough space for all the books to get published. And my idea was that if we wrote novellas, it's easy to publish a novella. It doesn't cost much to self-publish a novella. You can write a novella in like 3 to 6 months. And I actually bought a copy of Adobe and Lynda, which is now LinkedIn Learning, which like tells you how to use, you know, InDesign and stuff. And I posted the passwords for free on the internet that anybody who wanted to make novellas with me could make novellas. And I had this idea that it was going to be like a trans literary movement. It was going to be a continuation of this trans literary movement. In the end, not that many people took me up on the novella idea when I did it. But then after I stopped doing it, the novellas started getting passed like hand to hand. And they got this like cult following that I didn't actually have when I published them. Like when I published them again, like 800 maybe. But then over the next 3-4 years... it was just suddenly like there's a tattoo on the front of like one of them and like all these trans women started getting a tattoo from the book. It just there's a T for T tattoo on, it's on the face of a pig in the novella, which is not that flattering, but like I actually tattooed a real pig. I bought like so it's like it's this tattooed pig's face. And to do the cover, I like went to the local butcher, bought like a suckling pig, and did like a stick and poke on the pig's face. Because if you're doing a self-publishing, you want to do a cover, how else are you going to do that?
So, yeah, right.
And then all these, you know, it was like this kind of like nun symbol. And then all these other people started getting that same tattoo. And then by the time like Pose happened on TV and, you know, Transparent, and there were like this idea that trans was something that the culture was interested in. When the big publishers came around to Brooklyn and they were like, who's a trans writer? People had gave the editors my novel. And so it ended up being that the big publishing companies came to me rather than me going to them because of self-publishing. And that's why I'm like, when people are like, should you self-publish? I'm like, look, because of self-publishing, because of that, I didn't have to do the thing. And I did that. I had done this before early in my career and it didn't work out. Early in my career, I went and I was like a supplicant, like begging agents for attention. But after I self-published, those same agents, those same editors, they came to me instead because I already had like a voice or a vision and like an audience, and so they wanted what I had rather than me. Sorry about my voice. Rather than me begging for entrance, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So yeah, how did the Transition Baby kind of happen? What was its birth story?
I published those two novellas. And I didn't think, at the time, I didn't feel like they were a success. And because they're kind of edgy, even within trans community, there are a lot of trans people who were like, we don't necessarily agree with these. We don't like these. And I was sort of began to think, well, maybe I'm not writing for all trans people. Maybe I'm writing, instead of in terms of identity, maybe I'm writing in terms of affinity. That there's like people I have affinity with who may or may not be trans. And that, in fact, I have a lot of affinity with certain cis women. At the time, I was reading a lot of books by divorced cis women, which is why the Detransition Baby is dedicated to divorced cis women. And I was like, I feel like they're asking the same questions that I'm asking, that the trajectory of their lives look like my life. And then, in fact, I have a lot of affinity with certain cis women. Not all, certainly not all, but like, what if I started writing a novel for those people with whom I have affinity rather than whom I share an identity? And, you know, that kind of project shaped the initial questions that I was asking, like questions around motherhood. It shaped like the genre that I was working in, because I was like, I'm writing for women of all sorts with whom I have a certain affinity. And so it's like, I feel like it can be soapy, it can be dishy, it can be gossipy. And it can kind of do this domestic novel. Like, I was thinking about like Mary McCarthy's The Group, or I was thinking about, I mean, I'd read Ferrante and Rachel Cusk, especially like the Rachel Cusk, where Rachel Cusk was really angry. Like I really felt like the first and the second in the Outline trilogy, or like the memoirs about motherhood and aftermath about the divorce. Those were like angry books. And I was like, you don't think you're talking to me because I'm a trans woman. I mean, I don't think Rachel Cusk thought she was talking to me, but it turns out she was talking to me. And in the same way, I'm like, I feel like you don't think that I'm talking to you. Maybe Rachel Cusk doesn't think that I'm talking back to her. I don't know why I'm picking on Rachel Cusk, but let's just go with it. You know, is she on your podcast? Is she going to hear this? I was like, I want to talk back. I want to speak back to these books that felt like they were like looking right at me and talking to me. And that ended up determining everything in terms of like the form, the tone, what I was working out, because I thought that, you know, they had all this wisdom that helped me define the questions in my own life, and I had things to say about gender and I wanted to speak back to them.
So, changing the subject slightly, but I read that you have an off-grid cabin in Vermont, which I'm very interested in. Detransition Baby, as well as being about motherhood and parenthood, it's also very intrinsically a New York novel or a Brooklyn novel. Do you feel that your cabin lifestyle could potentially influence future work to be less city focused?
I mean, I think I didn't have it when I wrote Detransition Baby. It was like due to getting the advance and stuff that I was able to get this little cabin. And one of the things I think about a lot is the way that, like, queerness, but especially transness, has been an urban phenomenon where you live in a small town and then you move to a city and you find your community and et cetera, et cetera. But that there's like a kind of, there has been, at least in the United States, a counter movement to that going back years, especially in like gay and lesbian culture, where that people were asking, like, why does being gay or why does being queer have to be an urban thing? It's really hard to live in a city. You have to, like, deal with people all day long. Why can't we make these, like, communities, you know, in more rural places? And so I spent a lot of time at, like, communes in Tennessee. Tennessee is thought of as, like, a red state. It's thought of as, like, very conservative, but in fact dotted through Tennessee are these like queer communities that started out, you know, on land projects, but that eventually like became these queer neighborhoods that you can't tell if they're queer neighborhoods because they look like rural fields, but actually like, you know, all around it's like 100 of the farms around are queer and people help each other and they trade animals and they blah blah blah. And that for me is kind of beautiful. And I'm like, and I think that for a long time, transness had to be located in cities even more than queerness, because you had to have, there's a, especially if you're transsexual, there's like a material medical aspect to it. Like you have to find a clinic that will give you hormones. And
sure,
historically,
yeah.
So you had to be in a city. Historically, that meant, you know, only a few doctors, but really, getting hormones is incredibly simple. Most doctors can do it, no problem. It's not a complicated thing in terms of like the endocrinology or whatever. The only thing that's stopping local doctors from doing it is, you know, policy or prejudice or whatever, you know, is standing in the way. But it's not actually access or knowledge that is what's standing in the way. And so the thing is, there's actually no real reason why it has to be in a city. And there's and so much of the hardships of cities that make community hard don't exist in rural places. You can have community, you can share ideas, you can share with each other in rural places. And the kind of like artistic scenes that the way that stuff fell apart that I talk about in Brooklyn because of scarcity and like just simple questions of like, how am I gonna pay for rent? While being near my friends, that's not as much of a question in a rural space. So I actually am excited for the future of like transness and these kind of questions that I have to be set in rural places. And I am setting my future books in more rural places.
Fun little hint.
Yeah. And I feel like that, you know, sort of speaks slightly to the way in which the landscape of your own fiction is changing. But do you feel like the landscape of trans fiction in general is changing? And, you know, for the better, for the worse, like what is your read on how things are doing at the moment?
I mean, I think they're doing great. You know, I think I was just sent, they're on the shelf, I should get them. I was just sent two or three books from the UK of new books coming out this summer. We have Area of the Unwell by Liam Cardinal.
Yes, I'm reading that right now.
Yeah.
I think it's so, Arena of the Unwell. Is that right? Arena of the Unwell.
Yeah, sorry. Arena of the,
no, that's okay.
Arena of the Unwell. Arena of the Unwell is right here. I have Travis Alabanza's None of the Above, Reflections of Life Beyond the Binary. These are both coming out this summer. These are like people who I've like been vaguely aware of on Twitter and, you know, other kinds of things like that. And I think I had an interview with Liam. But
Travis is in America right now, doing the show Burgers on tour. So maybe it'll go to New York and maybe you can see it. It's great.
Oh,
I've seen it.
You know better than me about this stuff. So first of all, thank you for informing me. but you know, it's like, it's exciting to me that, I'm doing a reading with in August with Shola von Reinhold, who wrote Lote, and there's like a whole world of like of British trans writing that I think 10 years ago we wouldn't have been connected, really. You know, it would only be like one or two books that could be that you really would know about. And suddenly there's all these ideas moving, not just all over, not just in small scenes like what's happening in Brooklyn, but all over the world. I just read Bad Girls, which I think is translated as Queens of Sarmiento by Camila Sosa Villala, who's an Argentine trans woman writer. This book blew my mind. It's called Bad Girls in the States, Queens of the Sarmiento Park. They published it under a different title in the UK. It's called Las Malas in Spanish. You know, the bad girls. And it was incredible. It's like magical realism, sex worker stuff. It's got interesting politics about like the language around trans stuff, because the whole book's about trans sex workers who adopt a child. They find a child abandoned in the park where they're like on the stroll, and they adopt the child and try and basically raise the child. And I'm like, this is actually a corollary to the same questions that I was asking in Detransition Baby, but from like such a different perspective, such a different style. It's like, it's a little bit of like a magical realist style, but not, you know, like, not in the way that that's become like a cliche. It's doing something, it's like reinventing it to make these trans sex workers mythic. You know, it's mythic in the way that like the best Garcia Marquez feels mythic. And that's something I'd never read before. I'd never read trans women depicted as like worthy of myth in the way that she does. And that's not something I think I would have come up with on my own or like seen in a Brooklyn scene. And so there's this opportunity to have the scope of the questions that that we're sharing as writers be so expanded in a way that didn't seem totally possible 10 years ago, because a book like Camilla's wouldn't have been translated to English 10 years ago. It was a bestseller in Argentina. And that kind of possibility and that kind of these kind of conversations are super exciting. Like I feel like this is a pretty generative moment.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like the scene in the UK and globally as well, but in the UK, it's been really exciting. I remember about 5 years ago being commissioned to write an article about you know, top 5 books by trans writers. And I had to order Imogen Binney's Nevada, and I had to order Casey Plett. What was that one called again? A Safe Girl to Love. I had to order them from the US. Like there was nothing really here. Now, you know, like we had, is Alison Rumfitt on your radar? Did you read Tell Me I'm Worthless?
I haven't read it yet, but you know, it's like on my Kindle right now. And obviously, like, you know, I've talked to Sean Fay a couple times. I've talked, you know, there's at certain points We Touched came out this year. There's so many books happening in the UK. Juno Dawson is putting out so many books, and it's exciting. You know, it's like, that's just in the UK before you even get to what's happening in the United States. And I mm-hmm. love that we actually get to talk to each other instead of having sort of separately develop the same ideas.
Yes, exactly. And seeing the like the diversity across genre as well. You know, like that's really exciting too. Okay, so we only have a couple more questions for you before we'll let you go. The first one is, you kind of hinted at that you're working on something new at the minute.
Yeah.
Any spoilers for us? Any teasers?
Well, that was actually the last novella in the novella quartet. And it's
fun. Okay.
I have to finish it, but it's basically so each of the novellas is in a different genre. And this one has been like, is definitely the longest. It's like the most involved, but it starts out as, I guess you could call like a, everyone's been using this word recently, a Künstler Roman, you know, the journey of the artist.
Okay.
It starts like that in the Bildungsroman, I guess a Künstler Roman is the artist coming of age rather than just the person's coming of age. But it starts out as that, but really what I wanted was I wanted a Western. I wanted like a classic, like, and I was like, what would it mean to have trans women in this like extremely like storied kind of like American genre of this like very Western, I don't mean it in terms of the American West, but I mean like the assumptions that go into an American Western, whether the Western, I mean, I know that like in Australia, they write books about the Outback that are like sort of Western tropes. And I'm like, what happens when you put a trans woman in that? What happens to ideas of community? You know, the Western for me is like the sort of like ultimate expression of individuality over collective. And I'm like, what would it mean to write a trans woman into that kind of thing with all of the obviously problems and like that the Western as a genre brings with it, the sort of manifest destiny, the genocide, honestly, the environmental destruction. Where do trans women fit into that equation? Do they? And so I'm writing about two trans women who are siblings, who are like biological siblings, who moved to the Bakken, which is Montana and South Dakota, and it's where all the oil fracking happened in like 2012, where you know, there was when the oil prices rose, it was like all, they called them man camps. It was like every kind of like in the after the recession, like every sort of destitute, desperate guy in the United States moved to the middle of nowhere in these oil fields in Montana and South Dakota and North Dakota by the Canadian border, where there was like shale oil, and you could get paid like at the time, like, you know, you get like $18 an hour just working at Walmart out there. It was like so much money. It was like an actual like boom. And these men just lived in these like camps, and there was like all this violence and all of this like, crazy money, crazy overdevelopment. And this is only like 10 years ago. And I was like, this is an actual Western. Like, and my sister had moved out. My sister's a veterinarian, and she had moved out to the Bakken, and she would take care of these men were so lonely working in oil fields. She would take care of like their pets for them. Like the one thing they would like love is like these like long haul truckers would like love their snake who would like hang out in the truck with them. And my sister would like take care of it or take care of their dogs, or you know, some of them had like horses that they kept around or whatever. And I visited her like 10 years ago, and I was like, this is just a wild, wild thing that's happening. And then oil prices crashed, and the whole sort of world around that area disappeared. But it was like as close to like the gold rush as I think there's been in any sort of modern era, with all of the gold rush mentality. And it was so, it was like, you know, the population was like five men for every woman out there. It was so like just steeped in masculinity and testosterone. And when I come across something like that, that's like so gendered, but like also not marked as a highly gendered space, for me, that's just like so ripe to talk about what happens when a trans person who reveals the existence of gender shows up. And so I've got this whole plot around the West and capitalism and commodity booms and et cetera, et cetera. That is that I'm working on.
That sounds so interesting.
That sounds so exciting.
Thank you. I can't tell if it's like a great idea or if it's like, that's weird. Have fun with it. I mean, it's the kind of thing that like, this is when I say that, like, it's like, I'm trying to write like nobody is still watching me is like, this is the kind of thing I would have written 10 years ago, where I'm like, I'm writing a neo-Western with trans women in the oil fields, and like their particular niche is like vending machines. And so they're like these like vending machine queens of the Bakken. And it's
oh
like,
my God.
Because vending machines, you could charge so much money for like, there was no food out there. So people would set up vending machines. They charge like $10 for a candy bar. And so, and vending machines are a cash business. So like, you want a Western where you have exciting robberies and stuff. Where do you get a ton of cash? Vending machines. So if you act, if you're like the queen of the vending machines on the Bakken, you're rolling in like literal cash, no credit cards, cash. And for me, it's just like, it's a perfect setup.
Your mind, no,
sounds so good.
You are
yeah.
a creative genius. I just love it. I can't wait.
I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much for your time and for your incredibly interesting brain, and I've just loved chatting to you, and I'm sure Alice has too. It's been a true pleasure and delight, and we are crossing our fingers that you win at the British Book Awards on the 23rd of May. We want that for you, we want that for us, we want that for everyone. And yeah,
most importantly,
you.
We
yeah.
hope that you enjoy the award ceremony.
Yeah.
Hit that
yes.
free bar. Do you know what I mean?
Mom gets to go out, put on a dress, be fancy.
Like, just I'll go out, do it. Yeah, it's like the dream. Get to go to London and go to like a banquet.
Oh, heaven.
Yeah.
Well, thank you
all right,
once
well,
again.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a delight.
Thank you. Bye.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.